following podcast is part of the Underdog Sports Podcasting Network. For a full list of our shows, as well as breaking sports news and engaging feature stories, visit us at www.theunderdogsports.com.
Welcome back to Create Your Shot. I am Tyler Lorie, joined as always by Chris Smalls Angelos. And this week, like I said, former college basketball superstar, we have Mark Titus, the man behind Club Trillion, now works for The Ringer, does One Shining Podcast, which is hilarious, does his power rankings every Friday. And Smalls, this was as intuitive of an interview as I've ever heard, because we kind of bounced around with like, oh, Mark's a really funny guy. Like, and he told us beforehand that he didn't want to do shtick or anything like that. He didn't want to think of his answers beforehand. And we went pretty deep, honestly. I mean, we talked about college basketball. We told some jokes, but you know, buried in that is some unbelievable advice, especially with dealing with self-image, right? I was blown away.
Yeah, and for me, I think I just always take things as how it relates to me and relates to people that I know. And I think that was the most interesting, because I personally love his podcast. I don't read as much, but I love listening to his podcast with him and Tate, One Shining Podcast. And a lot of that is, you know, it's joking around, it's basketball, but really what we get into the depth of, you know, what he's went through personally, and you can relate a lot of that stuff to yourself. And then to also coaching and, you know, trying to get whatever industry you're going in, whatever job you're trying to get, there's so many factors that go into it. And sometimes you don't know what a person's dealing with, because people put on a happy face, like when they show up to practice or when they show up to their job, and they're this joyful person, but behind closed doors, they're battling with a lot of demons. So for me, on the serious end of that, that was really, really important, because that's not talked about enough in our industry, especially. Like, it is, you go through some really dark times, and sometimes you feel like you can't talk to anybody. What we want people to do is be like, you know, it's okay. It's okay, because someone goes through it as well. Someone really successful, like Mark, has went through the tough times and battled depression, and it's okay to be asked for help sometimes.
And the one thing I will say about this, and I think people who listen to Mark and read his work mostly think he's a really good person. But like, what I will say about that is, we did not know Mark before we filmed this episode. We reached out to him blind. He responded to an email and was totally open to doing it. Talked for an hour and 20 minutes or so, talked before the show, talked after the show. And the authenticity, I thought, was really tremendous. And that was where, you know, a lot of times you're worried, like, how are we going to get guests? How are we going to do this? And Mark was just kind of like, hey, I like what you guys are about. Like, we sent him the prep and he was all in. And I really appreciated that, because you could hear him trying to figure out the right answers to things. You could hear his kind of like trepidation in answering things. And we talked about a lot. You know, obviously there's a ton going on in college basketball with the investigation. There's a ton going on. We're going into conference tournaments. We're going to the NCAA tournaments. And we just talked about a lot of different stuff. And I really appreciated that, because this is a guy who, if you are Smalls and I's age, you know Club Trillion. You read him on Grantland. Like, he's a guy that was, like, he told us he was on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt on Selection Sunday. And I remember that now, but I had forgotten it. And so, like, he will not allow us to list accomplishments of his and say that, you know, he's done a lot of stuff. Mainly all he does is talk about basketball like a fan. But, like, Mark didn't have to reach back out to us. And I appreciate that about him. So I want people to know that I was really impressed with that authenticity. And like Small said, the part about where people don't kind of see what's going on behind closed doors, it's really interesting. And, you know, he does compare himself to Christian Bale and Batman. That's kind of interesting. I haven't heard that a lot of people saying like, oh, yeah, I'm like the Dark Knight. But I will keep this pretty short, Smalls, because we went long. But if you had one big takeaway, I think be yourself, right? I think don't let people impact how you act on a daily basis.
It's exactly what you said. Like, it's for us, it's not about people being big time. And he responded to an email that we sent, and he came on a podcast with us, like a lot less famous than him, obviously. And he's got a lot of things on his plate, and he takes time out of his day. And that means a lot to people like us. And I think if you can reflect that in your own life, that's really the most important thing for me, is when a kid comes up and you're an assistant coach at a Division I school, and there's a runner at an Elevate Hoops event comes up and asks you, you know, a couple questions, you can open up to them and, you know, be nice and be yourself. I think that's the most important thing, because that can go a long way for that other person when it really wasn't that difficult for you. So that's really what I took, out of the whole experience.
Yeah, definitely. And I will say this right now, we do have a mini-sode coming this Friday. Not 100% sure what we're going to do. I think we're going to do something on recruiting. For those of you that are enjoying the little 25 to 30 minute episodes, the Mike Dunn on shooting last week was really, really fun. If you haven't checked that out, listen to him talk about Devin Booker and us kind of talk about 3-point contests. Other than that, if you like what you hear, let us know about it. Subscribe, give us a 5-star rating, leave some stuff in the comments. Tell us what you like about our show, what you don't like about our show. Our DMs are open on Twitter at Create Your Shot. Send us a message. If there's people you want to hear on the show, we're more than willing to try to get guys on and listen to more stories. We are Create Your Shot Pod on Instagram, Create Your Shot on Facebook, and createyourshot@gmail.com. This, I believe, is the 34th episode. I don't know. At this point, it's amazing we're still on. You know, I think that's typical podcast shtick, right? Small is like, oh, we haven't been canceled, even though we produced the show ourselves. Yeah. But like I said,
keep on keeping on.
Enjoy the interview with Mark Titus. Also, we do talk a little bit about the college basketball investigation. Understand we are purely speculating on things. It's just kind of our opinion. None of us has really any idea what's going on. As we say, and I don't think many people outside and really in college basketball know a lot of what's going on. So please don't take what we say as gospel. It's just kind of us talking about current events. But like I said, enjoy the interview. Thanks as always for listening, and we will be back on Friday. Mark Titus from The Ringer, one shining podcast if you guys haven't listened, and formerly of Grantland. He also wrote a book, Don't Put Me In, Coach, My Incredible NCAA Journey from the End of the Bench to the End of the Bench. I believe, Mark, as you plug this plenty, it's available on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Probably got an audio book maybe with your voice. But former Ohio State walk-on, now media mogul, Mark, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for having me. It's a very exciting time here in Central Ohio. Ohio State, as we all know, is the one program that has never cheated and will never cheat, and every other program is cheating. So I'm very excited to see all the other cheaters go down, and for Ohio State to be exalted as they should be, honestly.
You know, actually, we're fired up too, because Temple's never cheated either. So the two-team NCAA tournament this year between Temple and Ohio State is going to be phenomenal. Like, we'll take a runner-up finish. We'll raise that banner. Nobody's going to know. They play the game, right? I mean, that's the most important part.
Right. If that's what it comes down to, in all honesty, if that literally happened and every other program was banned from the tournament, Ohio State was just handed a national title, I would be so obnoxious about winning that thing, as though as though we won it in the mid-80s with Patrick Ewing and Michael Jordan and James Worthy all and Akeem Olajuwon all competing against. Like, I wouldn't even care. Just give me the damn title. I'm taking it.
Well, getting to that, you know, your story at Ohio State, we don't talk about this as much anymore, although I know you get some heat on your podcast because people make it seem like you talk about how you were a player all the time, but yeah. You were in fact a walk-on at Ohio State, and you kind of wrote your journey for everybody to read, it for those that read the Club Trillion blog and then your book. When did you kind of decide that you were going to go into writing? And like, did you have kind of like a holy shit, this is a real thing moment in your career?
So the first question, I decided I was going to go into writing when Bill Simmons told me I was going to go into writing. And I was just like, okay, I guess so. The holy shit moment we had a very elementary, I say we, because my best friend from high school kind of helped me with the setting up the blog and kind of running the day-to-day operation, which like basically wasn't anything, but we both had a very elementary understanding of the internet and how to set up a website and all that kind of stuff. But we did figure out a way. This, and by the way, for people listening who are younger, like back in the mid-2000s, the internet was like a prehistoric place. I mean, it was like ancient as hell. So we found this like plugin that you could track your hits, how many people are coming to your website or whatever, you know, like that wasn't like very easy to get if you were just an independent guy back in those days. You know, like now it's I mean, everybody knows everything about their numbers or whatever. So I get this plug in after I'd been doing the blog for a little while, and I had no idea how many people were reading the website. And then we do it, and we started like tracking it, and it was, I was getting like 50,000 hits a day. And this was before I'd even done any media. And at that point I was like, that was my holy shit moment. I was like, holy shit, you're telling me that 50,000 times people are coming to this every single day. And then I go on like Simmons podcast. I like media started to pick it up because they thought it was hilarious that this guy on the end of the bench was just kind of dicking around and was basically the way I pitched it to people was like, I'm the anti Rudy. Like Rudy is trying to kiss everyone's ass and do whatever he can to get in the game. And I was like, nah, you know, I'm good. So after that all starts to happen, people like kind of get the media stuff. Like we were getting like 150, 200,000 visitors a day or whatever. And I was like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. I've really got something now. I guess like getting hate mail was kind of cool too, in a weird way. Cause like when you first start out, it's just your mom and she's like, hey, I read your blog. It was really good, Mark. And I'm like, hey, mom, shut up. I don't want anyone to know that's you. You know, like she's commenting in the section, you know, like, good job, Mark. And I'm like, mom, don't.
Mark's mom. That's.
Yes. So when I started getting hate mail, I was like, man, I must have kind of arrived at like people are reading this who don't even like me. This is crazy. But that could have been my dad, though, I guess.
It was all hate mail, actually, probably Evan Turner. It was just Turner. Like writing a couple different posts a day from different IP addresses.
That's very, very plausible. So that's definitely plausible. But I guess like to answer your question, though, like that was kind of it. Like I started the blog, honestly, as just an outlet to voice my frustrations. I wasn't getting any playing time. I didn't necessarily think I should be getting playing time, but it's still just a tough pill to swallow when you're the best player on your team all through high school. Yeah. And you're, you know, I could have gone and played Division I basketball somewhere and I chose not to. And it was all like I created the situation myself. So I'm not pretending to be a victim or whatever, but it's just sort of, it was a reality check to get to Ohio State and realize I sucked at basketball. And that the blog became my outlet for that. It was like, I either have to transfer somewhere where I can play or I have to like completely change my attitude about this. So I changed it and it was just supposed to be like a little fun thing where I was just kind of voicing my frustrations in a humorous way. And then when people started actually paying attention to it, that's when I was like, holy shit, this is nuts that, you know, they're showing, they're talking about, I remember getting mentioned on ESPN during like a SportsCenter thing. You know, like our team wins and someone said like Club Trill shout out, or, you know, like one of the anchors said something like that. I was like, what the hell? it happened really early on, but I didn't realize I wanted a career certainly for much longer. It took like graduating and all that for that.
Yeah. And you mentioned you're the anti Rudy. Well, you really are, because Rudy sucked. Like Rudy stopped. He didn't have any business being on that field. You were a good high school player, right? You played all Ohio Red, yeah, I mean, Greg Oden, and all that.
Well, yeah, we were from Indiana. We played. We were Spies Indy Heat. Spies Indy Heat. All Ohio Red was like the other Ohio. All Ohio Red was like the JJ, or not JJ. JJ Solinger's got really excited that I mentioned his name. It was Jared Solinger.
Trey Burke. Aaron Kraft.
Yeah. Yeah, Trey Burke was in. Yeah, it was that group, but. Yeah, I mean, I'm not delusional about my basketball career or anything. Like, I would say I was pretty good. I was not anything special. I scored 1,000 points in my career. I played at the biggest division in Indiana. I was on the varsity team as a freshman, like that sort of stuff. But it wasn't like, I mean, at no point was I like, I'm going to the NBA. That point happened when I was like in seventh grade, and then I stopped growing, and I realized I'm not, because I was 6'4 in eighth grade.
Jesus.
And I'm 6'4 now. Yeah. So there was a moment where I was in middle school. I was like, oh shit, I'm kind of good at basketball. This is insane. And then there's a moment in high school. I was like, oh shit, I'm not good at basketball anymore. This is insane.
You said you were recruited to other schools. Did you, like, what schools recruited you? And what made you the decision to go to Ohio State instead of those?
Yeah, so I guess I got recruited. I mean, I got like letters. You guys know how this goes. You get letters from letters doesn't mean shit.
I sent out like 500 a week.
I was still on the mailing list at least with like basically every school in Indiana, which I thought was cool. Like I knew what it was, but at the same time, to get letters from Indiana and Purdue and Notre Dame, I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. But no, I was more like Indiana State was recruiting me, but. I never really had much interest in Indiana State. UNC Wilmington was the one I was pretty interested in. There was mutual interest there. Harvard was the one I thought I had, I was going to go to. I had it basically down to like Harvard and UNC Wilmington. And I had made up my mind I was going to Harvard. And then I wrote about this in my book, actually. There's a story where the Harvard coach, who I had been talking to forever, had seen me play 1,000 times. He was in town in Indianapolis for another reason. He was like recruiting another guy at the same time. And he was like, "Hey, I'm going to swing by your game and just see what's going on." And that sort of thing. So I was really excited because we were playing our biggest rival. We were playing in an important tournament against our biggest rival. And I was really excited for this to happen. And then in the lead up to that game, my coach got mad at me in practice because I wasn't rebounding well enough. And I got into a fight with him because I was like, "Coach, I'm a shooting guard. I know I'm kind of tall for a high school player, but I'm a shooting guard. I'm averaging 7 rebounds a game. I don't know what you want from me." And we kind of butted heads. And then he benched me the whole first half that the Harvard coach came to. And when I came out in the second half, the coach was gone. I ended up scoring like 17 points in the second half and we won. But the coach had left and I never heard from him again. And that's kind of how the Harvard thing fell through. So anyway, when that fell through, I was interested in UNC Wilmington, but I was so set on Harvard. I was like kind of bummed out. And then Greg Oden and Mike Conley were like, "Dude, just come to Ohio State. You don't need basketball. Just come hang out with us." And I was like, "Yeah, honestly, that kind of sounds fun. I think I'll do that." So yeah. So that's what I did, more or less. That was kind of how I ended up at Ohio State. My first time I ever set foot on Ohio State's campus was when I was moving into my dorm, believe it or not, which is kind of irresponsible, I think would be one word for it.
I would say that people who know you, like, or listen to you and read your work would not say that, like, you're not anything but pretty laid back. So that's not that surprising to me. I guess it's like a little surprising because, you know, like parents are always like, "Oh, where are you going to go to school? Like, let's take visits. Like, let's do this." But I got to say, like, that's not super surprising to me. But I do know that when you went there, though, weren't you set up to be a manager before you were actually a walk-on?
Oh, yeah.
And then you got
– I was a manager.
You got fired, right? Like, you didn't work out.
It was one of those mutual firings, I think, is how it worked. I was I'm not afraid to throw guys under the bus with this because I've done it so often and publicly for so long that it's like, who cares at this point? I'm going to keep doing it. John Gross, who was the coach at Illinois, just recently got fired at Illinois and is now the coach at Akron. Yeah. Who I like. I like Gross a lot. I just saw him this summer and I'm not going to say like bad things about him. That's not where this is going. But John Gross grew up in the same town that I grew up in, actually. And he knew – I knew him through various channels. He was an assistant coach at Ohio State. I should preface it with that. He was an assistant coach at Ohio State, and my family knew his family, and we kind of had this connection going. And I obviously knew Greg and Mike. So when I got to Ohio State, Gross reached out to me because he was like, "Yeah, I remember Mark." And when he was recruiting Mike and Greg, he'd seen me in AAU games and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of built up a relationship with him a little bit. And when I got there, he was in charge of kind of recruiting me to the manager gig. And he called me and he's like, "Hey, I know you want to be around Mike and Greg. I know how much you like those guys. We think that you're valuable because we know how good you are at basketball. We would love, you know, maybe run scout team and stuff. So here's what we're offering you. Come be a manager and you'll get to do scout team and you'll get to play the role of the best shooter on the other teams and you'll get to practice against the guys." And I'm like, "Oh, this sounds amazing." And he's laying it out for me. And I'm like, "So do I have to come to every practice?" And he's like, "No, not really. Just, you know, whenever you can, just come whenever." Because I was at this point, I was like really serious about my studies. I was trying to go to medical school. I was a math major and I was trying to, you know, like I can't be taking a huge time away to go run scout team, you know. So I was kind of basically we had this negotiation where we were planning what the manager role would be. And I thought it was going to be awesome. I was like, "This is great. I'm going to get my basketball fix, but I'm not going to, you know, kill myself trying to be a D1 athlete." And then I get there and they have me filling up water bottles and wiping up sweat. And I was like, "Wait a second. This is not what I had in mind." And they're like, "Well, what's the problem?" And I was like, "Well, when do we do the scout team thing?" And they're like, "Well, that's not for a little while, you know, just you have to be older." I don't know. It was like this whole thing. So then they're like, "Okay, you don't want to wipe up sweat. You don't want to rebound for guys. What if we made you film practice?" And I was like, "Okay, cool." So I go sit up in the crow's nest, basically, and I'm filming practice. And I get so bored doing this. And Coach Mata loves telling this story. It's like his favorite story about me to tell. I basically stopped moving the camera as the action like goes from side to side, which is kind of a problem. So the funniest part is like I would notice I had forgot to move the camera. So I got the cameras on the left and all the actions on the right. And then I would go, oh shit, I forgot to move the camera. And so I would go to move it as the action would go back to the left, and I would be moving the camera to the right. And it was an absolute mess. So they kind of called me in and they're like, do you want to be a manager? And I was like, honestly, no. Can I quit? And they're like, yeah, quit. Just why, you know, like, you know, you're not going to hurt our feelings. And I was like, all right, thank God, I'm out of here. And then I quit. And so I know I'm rambling. I'm sorry. No, I'm talking a lot, but I quit being a manager. And then 2 weeks later, they called me back and they basically asked me to walk on because at the time, Greg Oden had, his wrist was broken and it was still healing. One of the guy who was a walk-on, they had played an exhibition game already, and this walk-on thought he was going to play a lot for some reason. I don't know why. We were a preseason top five team, and I guess he thought he was going to get starters minutes. I'm very confused by that. But this walk-on that they had quit because he was like, you know, I don't want to ride the bench. And then Ron Lewis rolled his ankle in practice, and we were down. They were down to nine players, and they couldn't even run 5-on-5 at that point. So they basically called me. They're like, we just want you to go out there and just be a punching bag. And we literally just need you because we need to run 5-on-5. That's the only reason we're calling you. And then I said the right things and did the right things and made the right people laugh or something. And I turned that into 4 years. And here I am now talking to you guys. So that's pretty much the story.
The best part about that is you guys have this dirty laundry segment on your podcast, which is apparently like incredibly popular now. Cause I noticed you're like misdoing the timestamps. So people listen before dirty laundry.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that, honestly. But like, You love managers. Like you openly talk about how awesome you think managers are. But in your story, you know, for guys like Smalls and I who were both managers, like, you know, you were the guy that was like, I'm too good to fill up the water bottles. And that guy was always, you know, he was always the black sheep of the managers. Like he wanted to be friends with the players.
Right.
And it's funny because like your like love for managers it definitely shines through at this point in your life.
Are you calling me a fraud?
No, is that honestly, what you're doing? I'm not. I don't think so.
No, listen, I know I was an, I don't know if asshole is probably a strong word to call me. I think it was just, you have that moment where for my entire life, basketball was a certain thing. Like if I was going to a basketball practice, this is what it looked like. This is what it felt like. And it was just an ego bruise. Like I never thought while I was there that I should be playing. Like when I was doing the manager thing, I was never like, I'm better than you guys and I should be out there with the real team or anything like that. It was just, it was very, very hard to take on a different role because, again, I was a pretty good player in high school. And like even people don't believe this. Even on our AAU team, which we had like one of the greatest AAU teams ever, I would say it's the greatest. But I mean, objectively, it's got to be one of the five best of all time.
Yeah, at least in terms of guys who like, because Daquan Cook was there, right? Like
Josh McRoberts, Eric Gordon was on the team as well. Yeah, we had 13 guys. 11 of us played Division I basketball. One I think played for professional baseball out of high school, and that's why he didn't play Division I basketball. And then I forget what happened to the other guy. Maybe he, we don't need to get into him. But anyway, on that team, like I actually played a lot. I actually got a ton of minutes in AAU. I was like a vital part of that team even. So to go from that to now I'm filling up the water bottles for like my friends basically, which is the other part of it too. I don't want to be friends with the players. Right. I already was friends with the players, you know? So that was like really weird to like, I don't know. I've been an equal, I mean, not equal in talent, but just equal in position with Greg and Mike for so long. Like we would always play against each other. We're hanging out with each other. And now suddenly like I'm doing things for them. So that's all that was. But the reason I love managers so much is because I identify with that. Like I was like, this was a job that I could not do. I don't understand how these people do this. God bless them. As I became a real player and I went to practices more, I spent more time hanging out with managers, talking to managers. It kind of got flipped on its head. Like when I was a player, I was like, I want to be friends with the managers versus the other, you know. So I don't know. That's pretty much where all that comes from. Is just like all the managers we had at Ohio State were awesome. I loved all those guys. They got into the most crazy situations. Like I kind of got jealous of them because while the nights before games, I'm stuck in a hotel on campus because they don't trust us. We can't go out or anything. Like I know that the managers are doing crazy shit. So. I love managers. Yeah.
Yeah. After we end taping, I'll give you a dirty laundry and I'll change names and stuff. And if you're writing it down, you can take it. Cause we have some like that part of being a manager was the best. Like it was funny. Like coaches would openly, like they treat you decently well. Like they treat you kind of like you were players in the sense that like they yell at you and stuff, but like you know, you're kind of along for the ride, but your responsibilities are so limited. As long as you show up and do what you're supposed to do, like nobody right. cares about you. So like right. numerous times, like guys would show up or miss breakfast, miss meal at night. And they'd be like, oh, where's that guy? And you'd be like, I don't know, but he'll be here tomorrow and he'll have the water bottles filled up and like he'll have right. his polo on. And like, that's the part of it that's really funny. And I didn't mean that in the sense that like you thought you were better than us, just in the joking factor. Because I don't think people realize if they didn't read your book, I don't think people realize that you were a manager. Like, I think they just assumed, like, oh, he was a walk-on. And thank God you weren't the walk-on who was, like, thinking that he needed to quit off a team that was going to go play in the national championship and robbed himself of that experience as well. So, like, you know, I just think, like, that part's interesting. But I do wonder, like, as you were getting bigger in media, you know, like, and as you kind of – as you graduated and took the next step forward, like – Do you network on like a pretty regular basis? And like, how do you network? Do you network with coaches? Do you network with other media members? Like kind of as you grow your career now, you know, what's your approach?
You'd be surprised. I think people would be surprised by how little I talk to people. And part of that is because of my personality. I wouldn't say I have a shtick publicly, but I certainly have a personality publicly that I'm like the fun guy that makes jokes and doesn't take things seriously. And I'm very outgoing and stuff, but I'm honest to God, I live the most boring life you could possibly imagine. And I live in the suburbs of Central Ohio, which like telling even people like I know in New York and LA, if I tell them I live in Columbus, Ohio, they think I live in the middle of nowhere. I live in the middle of nowhere compared to where Columbus, Ohio is, you know, like I say that to say like I don't live an exciting life, so I don't really reach out to a lot of people. I bump into people like at games and stuff, and I'll tell them I'm a fan of their work and just kind of shake hands that way. Sometimes I just reach out like on Twitter. That seems to be a useful way to network. But honestly, I don't do a ton of networking. As far as coaches, I know very, very few coaches, and that's by design. I mean, the coaches I do know are coaches that entered my life because they were assistants on teams I played in, or they were close, like they coached under coaches that I know. So I kind of got in touch with them that way, or they reached out to me. Like there have been a handful of coaches that reached out to me. Some were like, hey, I thought that was funny what you wrote. Others were like, how dare you? I hate you. Like, please explain. Yeah, that's a certain coach at a certain school that I grew up cheering for called me a couple times to kind of say like, you're writing mean things about me, please stop it. But I would say that's kind of why I don't network. I think subconsciously I don't want to be influenced. I don't want to like have friends in this. I will, like, if something funny happens with Sean Miller at Arizona, I want to make Sean Miller jokes, and I don't want it to be like, ooh, well, you know, Sean coached under Thad Mata and I'm close to Thad, and I don't want to upset Thad. And you know, like to me, it's just more fun to be able to just, I speak from a place of fandom. I'm just a college basketball fan. So the more you network to me, the less of a fan you are.
Which is why you work well with Bill Simmons, because like ultimately, like that's who, you know, when all of us were reading Bill Simmons in like the early, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, like that's who Bill Simmons was. Like he was a guy writing about sports in a bar. And so like that's his, you know, that's like not his shtick, but like that's kind of who he is. And like, I get that, because like when we thought about starting to do this podcast, we were like, well, we can get all these guys on and they'll tell hilarious stories about being coaches. But like a lot of times coaches won't do that because there's this sort of like inner brotherhood. And now, you know, apparently the FBI is just going to blow it up. But like there's this like coaches bond where like you just don't talk about things that are going on. And that's why like it's just kind of like crazy in that regard, you know, where there's nothing wrong with you talking about current events and like making jokes about Sean Miller sweating, you know, under like an FBI light, you know, like that everybody else is doing it because you're Mark Titus and you played on a team where Archie Miller coached, like that could be a problem, right?
Right. Yeah. And Archie, I love Archie as well. So, which by the way, I'm not afraid to do that, but I think there is definitely a hesitation. Like I catch myself right now as I want to talk about Sean Miller. I do catch myself sometimes. I still say it. I still make the joke, but there's just that little pause. And I think about like, what would this be like if I was close to every coach? But I do, I mean, I am well networked. I mean, you're in basketball long enough. You know, a lot of people, you run into a lot of people. It just kind of, I'm better networked. I don't mean to say that I'm just some guy, some bump on a log that just sits on his couch and that's the only perspective I offer. But, I don't know. I've always valued the fan perspective more. I mean, I was a fan of basketball well before I was a player, well before I ever thought about having a college career. I was 3 years old just watching basketball and was obsessed with it. And that's just been true my whole life. Like, I'm still a fan. I was a fan of the game. Even when I was at Ohio State, like, I was a fan of the game. Like, I would be excited to meet other coaches. I remember the first time I walked into a practice at Ohio State, I got excited that Thad Mata was there. I was like, that's the guy who I remember him as Xavier. I remember him at Butler. It was never like, this is the basketball coach who's going to coach me now. It was just like, I know your history. I'm a fan of you, whatever. So anyway, that's a long-winded way of saying that I value that fan perspective, and I think that's kind of my way of preserving it, is to sort of not necessarily be aggressive in my networking.
Yeah, and I want to take this in a little bit of a different direction, but we created our podcast because we want to help young coaches or young media people, and sometimes you need a way of hearing different people and different perspectives. But you've talked about depression in your past at Ohio State and following while at Grantland. How did you manage to kind of grow from that? And are there any tips for people who might be struggling in that, same way you were?
That's a tough question, because I think everybody, I don't think everybody's different. I know everybody's different. And I've never tried to pretend that whenever I talk about depression or I wrote about it, I've never tried to pretend like there's a cure, like my method is a cure all for everyone else. So I certainly want to, I guess, preface it with that and say that this isn't, every case is different, and I don't have the answers. I had the answer. I figured out the answer for me. It might not be the answer for everybody, but I guess for me, it was just about the routine. I think I found a routine. I don't even know where to start, to be honest with you. It was just like the method I came up with was just trying to build momentum. I that's a word that just stuck with me forever. Was like, if I just do the little things, then they become the medium things, and then they become the big things, and they become the really big things. And you just start there, and that's kind of the approach I took. I mean, it was very, very hard for me, though. It's still weird to talk about, if you can't tell from the way I'm stuttering as I'm trying to work through my thoughts here. It's hard to talk about for that reason, is that I know how serious it is. And I know that there are a lot of people that are going through it. And I guess I worry that people want me to tell them the answer, and then they try that and it doesn't work, and now they're out of options or something. And I guess, like, the one thing that I do enjoy about, like, telling my story is that, with this part of it, is that I am living proof that it does get better. I swear that I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life. I have it under control. I certainly don't think I'm cured of depression. I don't think that's ever possible. The analogy I would use is that it felt like I was in a pit, just like a big hole that's been dug out, like Batman Begins analogy, I guess. Like, that's
Dark Knight.
I
was down. Dark Knight Rises.
Was it the third one, right?
Where you get Bane throws him down there, and then he breaks his back, but somehow he heals without a doctor in this.
I thought that was, that's right. It's the Dark Knight Rises. My God, look at my Batman. I watched all those movies one time, and I just remembered it was Christian Bale. You know that. But anyway, you know the visual. Like, I felt like I was in this pit, and there was I had this rope wrapped around my ankle, and there's a guy in that pit whose job is to keep me in the pit. And every time I try to climb out, he just pulls on the rope and tugs me down. Right. And I would say that right now I've climbed out of the pit, and I've walked, I'm 30 miles away from the pit at this point. I've walked all the way away from it, but I still have that rope around my ankle. And I will always have that rope, and I will always kind of feel a nudge, and I can feel that guy down in that pit just kind of like, hey man, come back. It's not too late. You can still be miserable. So I say that to say, like, I'm not trying to paint this with sunshine and rainbows and all that. And like, once you figure it out, man, then you're happy and jolly and everything's great for the rest of your life. Cause that's definitely not the case, but there are ways you can get through it. I would just encourage people to experiment with stuff. The hardest part about depression is just doing. That's always been the hardest part. I would just lay in bed, and I would know what I have to do, and I just wouldn't be able to do it. And so for me, it was small things. It was like, instead of trying to save the world today, instead of trying to beat depression, what if I just woke up to, what if I just got out of bed before noon? And we'll start with that. Like, how about today? Just try to get out of bed before noon. And I would do that, and I'd be like, hey, I did it. Wow, that was amazing. And the next day it's like, all right, now I'm going to try to get out of bed before noon. And what if I make my bed after I get up?
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it. And like, honestly, it sounds absolutely ridiculous to people that haven't been through it. But like, I mean, if you're dealing with that, like getting out of bed before noon for me was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this.
I want to jump in for 1 second. Sorry to cut you off, Smalls. And I think the reason we wanted to include this was because one of the things I thought was most interesting about your situation is it obviously took you a little while to write it, and it was going on while you were still at Ohio State, where to like the outside observer, it seemed like everything was great with Mark Titus. You know, you're staying in super awesome suites at the Final Four, and like, you know, you're just having a blast. Like, and I think in basketball and sports in general, like people are afraid to like show who they actually are and what's going on behind the curtain, because you're viewed as like, you know, we'll go into coach speak in a minute, but like you're viewed as soft, or like you're viewed as like not a winner or whatever. And so like, it's important, I think, to have these conversations. And like, just for people who don't know, it's February 26th. This will air tomorrow, or February 27th. But DeMar DeRozan actually just had a really interesting piece at Smith Raps on Twitter, wrote about him talking about depression and anxiety too. And like those types of conversations, I think, especially in the sports world, you need to have. So Mark, like that's, I didn't mean to put you on the spot, you know, and I appreciate the authenticity, you know, cause you can tell like it's not easy.
Listen, I think it's important for me to be candid. I don't even think it's important. I think it's my responsibility to be candid about this, because when I was in that position, there was nothing more in the world than I wanted than for someone successful that I looked up to and to know that they went exactly through the same thing I did. And it's still a weird position for me to be in, where I'm kind of on the other end of it. Like I have to remind myself that people do look up to me, which is absolutely bizarre, because I swear I have like no ego. I even saying that makes you an asshole with an ego. I know.
But, yeah, you have a big time ego.
It seriously like trips me out when people want my autograph or people want pictures with me and all that kind of stuff. I've never really thought of myself as like, you know, someone that someone would look up to. But then I've slowly like kind of realized that is the case. I think there are, I mean, whether there's 5 or 10 or maybe even 12, let's get crazy and say there are 12 people out there that look up to me. If even one of them, you know, hears my story and is like, oh shit, that guy that I really look up to is also been depressed like his entire adult life. Wow, maybe there is hope for me. Like that honestly, it means a lot to me. So I have no problem being candid. I mean, I've told this story publicly before. I don't know how many people have come across it. Like there were days on the basketball team, I'll never forget. I put a belt around my neck one night and I fall to, I wasn't suicidal, I wouldn't say, but I just kind of was at that. I mean, obviously that's not a healthy spot to be in when you're putting a belt around your neck. I had no intention of like going all the way with it, but I had a belt around my neck. I kind of pulled on it just to see what it'd feel like. I collapsed to the floor, started sobbing in my apartment that I live by myself in, fell asleep on the floor after sobbing, fell asleep with this belt around my neck, woke up at 7:30 in the morning, got to the gym by 8, cracking jokes in practice, making fun of everybody. And that went on like that happened a lot when I was at Ohio State. And that's just how bad it was. I mean, that was and I think you're absolutely right that I certainly was never going to walk into the locker room and be like, hey, guys, just want to let you know last night I had a belt around my neck because you can't do that.
If you had gone in and said that, would you have wanted the guys in the locker room to be naked or not naked when you gave them that comment?
Yeah.
But I mean, like, right. That's the part about this that's so interesting. And then we'll get into some college basketball talk for people, you know, or I guess Smalls and Mai's mom will listen. And hopefully, you know, your mom will listen to this as well. So we'll get three people.
Yeah, but like, oh, she'll definitely.
It's the part in sports where like people you can't. And this is just an ongoing theme every single time we have people on the podcast. Like you can't be afraid to be yourself, and like you can't be afraid to like let people in. And your network is strong, but it doesn't necessarily need. You don't need to tell the 1,000 people you reach out to every day to be like, hey, great game last night, that you're not feeling that way. But you need to have a support system around you that like you feel like, okay, these are the issues that I can go through, and these people aren't going to judge me. And I think people in basketball, I think they just worry about being judged way too much.
Well, Tyler, like, yeah, we talk about it with coaching, and there's coaches, like, it's like this thing that everyone thinks like coach is a superhero. They're these untouchable guys. Their lives are so good. But these young guys like me and Tyler and like other guys who were working for $1,000 a year at, you know, smaller schools, and we're just trying to make it. You have those times where it really sucks and you're like, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. I don't know if I want to do this anymore. So you go through those tough times, and sometimes it's like Tyler said, like you need a support system and you need to be able to like talk about it and stuff.
Yeah. Cause you can't succeed without it, Mark. I mean, I think that's what you're getting at too. And like, unfortunately with your situation, it sounds like you went through a lot of it yourself until you kind of were like, okay, I'm going to solve this.
Yeah. Well, it's for all the reasons you said. I mean, I was placed in a macho environment to be like, hey guys, I'm very screwed up in the head and something's going on here. Was completely unnatural to me. I was just raised like, I don't mean raised in the sense that my parents instilled this in me. I think it was just kind of the environment I was placed in. But I was sort of raised to be a suck it up and deal with it kind of guy. And again, that's not like my dad never explicitly said those words to me. It was just sort of the culture you're brought up in sports and stuff. So that was pretty much it. And I value authenticity at this point. Like that's kind of, as I've gotten older, I've definitely shifted into that. And I think that carries over in like all the work I do publicly with media stuff is just, I think that's the number one thing I care about most is just being authentic. And it's like, you might not like me. You might wish I took things more seriously. I get that. A lot of people come read my articles and they're like, shit, I was hoping for more X's and O's. I don't like this guy. And listen, that's fine. Like that's your prerogative. But when you read what I write or you listen to what I do on a podcast or whatever, that's 100% me. I'm not manufacturing it. I know I brought up like how I play some shtick a little bit. Like I have fun with stuff here and there, but like that's just who I am. I'm not afraid to talk about that kind of stuff because I think there's no point. It just doesn't serve anybody for me to not be that way. That's just kind of how I've always viewed it. Like to be somebody different just makes no sense. And plus it'd be exhausting. It's hard enough being me. I can't try being another version of me also. Like what the hell?
So easy segue here. College basketball. Who can win the tournament this year? That's what I want to know. Like, I know you watch a lot of college basketball, but you know, who can do it?
Yeah. Honestly, anybody. That's what's awesome about this. This is like the craziest season, not even for the off-court stuff, but like the on-court is just absurd. It's impossible to figure anything out. And it sucks for guys like me because this is the time of year where people are asking me like, well, hey, who should I put in my bracket? I'm like, dude, I don't know. For God's sake, have you been paying attention? Like there have been 7 or 8 teams that have been ranked in the top 5 that have then fallen out of the rankings after being ranked top 5, which is absolutely – maybe that happens once a year, maybe twice on any other year, and it's happened like 7 or 8 times this year. But the teams that like jump out to me, I'd say I really like Michigan State. I know they've had their problems on the road. I know they haven't played like the greatest schedule in the world. But I mean, they just kind of the firepower they have is undeniable. And they just seem like a team that they look the part, if that matters to anybody. I think they play great defense. I really like Michigan State. I think Duke is figuring it out playing defense lately. Got Bagley. Everyone thought Bagley was the reason when like Bagley goes out and they start playing defense well. They're like, oh crap, are we better without Bagley? And then Bagley comes back and is like, no, you're not.
They've been playing so much more zone. It's like they finally figured out like, okay, we need to work on this in practice. Like let's not try to play a defense that we've run a couple sets against back in October. And now they're getting a lot better at it. You know, it's just that they don't have guys that really guard great. Like honestly, Gary Trent Jr. is probably the worst perimeter defender on the team. Bagley's got his own issues and like who he's going to guard next level, I'm not sure. But like it was hilarious watching Gary Trent Jr. try to get stops late in games when they were in man. It's so bad. Yes. Like.
Well, zone people you guys know this. These college kids are idiots. College basketball players cannot run offense against the zone. They're so stupid. Like the reason coaches don't want to run zone is because they're like, well, if we run zone, then we're vulnerable here and here, and they'll just put it here and dunk on us and shoot three. And yeah,
it's just not true.
The offense is never figured out.
It's just not true. Like the only thing I'd be worried about is if I played zone against a really good offensive rebounding team, because the other team miss a ton of threes that they take that are terrible early and late in the shot clock, and I'd be worried about that if I didn't rebound. But in terms of like, there's got to be like 3 teams in the country that are good at zone offense. I mean, and I don't even know if I can't even think of a guy that I'd be. I think Dana Altman is pretty good in those settings. And then I thought Fred Hoiberg was pretty good back in the day, you know, when he was at Iowa State. But I don't know a ton of coaches. Maybe Jim Boeheim, because his players just play it all the time in practice. But
Bill Self has a ton of sets out of zone. The zone offense turns into just windshield wiper, chuck up threes. But I know he's got a big playbook. But yeah, I'm with you, though. Like nobody – I think players just get bored. Like they go up against the zone and they're like, well, we got it to the high post last time. Do we really need to do that again? Like that's
you know what the best part, Mark, in my opinion, of like watching zone, like teams go up against the zone is like late in the first half or like early in the second half when coaches are like, I just found out this awesome zone busting thing. What if we set a ball screen at the top of the zone? What if we run our man sets? How's that going to work? And you're just like, oh my, like this is insane. Like just just run your stuff. If you run your offense good, it probably really doesn't matter what defense you're against. If your guys are really good at offense, yes. Like you can run man sets. But coaches also panic and they're like, okay, we're going to run our six zone sets we have. Like, get it to our big man who's 3 assists to 28 turnovers this year. He'll make great plays out of the high post. It's like, yep. It's insane to me. But I think Duke, I think, what about Virginia this year in terms of?
I believe in Virginia. I like Virginia.
They have really good players. Like, I know people love Tony Bennett,
Virginia. The concern with Virginia is a concern I've always had is how slow they play, and I don't say that as a pace. The word they use is paces for Virginia fans. I'm not a pacist when I say that. I think it's just when you have better players than the other team, you want more possessions to prove that your players are better, you know? So
it gives you more margin for error.
Yeah. And that's always my concern going into the NCAA tournament with Virginia is that it just takes that one game where, you know, when you only have like 30 possessions in a game, if 5 of them go wrong, like that's a huge chunk of your possessions, you know? So that's the one concern. But like, as far as Virginia as a team, I mean, their defense is unbelievable. Not just good. I feel like there's this sense of like Virginia's a gimmick almost. Not. For people that don't really follow, and they are not. They're absolutely not. They have legitimate players. They have, I mean, I absolutely love Virginia. I always have, not always, but I mean, like in the recent years since they've become really good and people have kind of hated on them for scoring 46 points a game. I've seen through that. I see like how well they play together, how certainly on the defensive end, how cohesive they are. And I do think they're definitely good enough to win a national title. I very much believe.
How about
in them.
One sleeper? Like one team that is, I mean, I guess like there's not a lot of sleepers because a bunch of teams have been ranked, but like one team that maybe is outside of the top 15 that you feel could make some noise.
I got to pull up the top 15. I got to see what the, let me see here. Did the rankings change? They change so often, it's impossible to know. I guess Arizona's out of the top 15. That'd be interesting, right?
Yeah, and they're definitely good enough. Like, getting back to Arizona for just like 1 second, we'll talk about the investigation for like a minute, but I'll, you know, you guys will go way more in depth on your podcast. But like, this Alonzo Trier suspension is insane, first of all. And I guess like it's great for Arizona that now people think Sean Miller's paying guys $100,000 because now nobody's talking about the fact, or the NCAA rather, now no one's talking about the fact that he got suspended for something that happened in 2016 for a drug test he took probably 12 months later when he was more than likely dehydrated after a game and like he's not playing now. I don't understand. Like, this is why the NCAA just
makes no sense.
So many mind-boggling decisions that it's just so wild that now we're looking at no Alonzo Trier. And then, I mean, I just want to say that I wouldn't sit any of my players if they came up in the investigation right now and I'd force the NCAA to prove that they did something wrong. Because I don't know how much information is really out there. I think some of these reports are pretty crazy. Like, I think ESPN... I don't know. I don't want to go on the record and say I think that ESPN reporters aren't good at their jobs. I just think this is a total mess. I think they have no clue of what they're reporting. So, like, I hope nobody sits anybody and they force the NCAA to step in and be like, you can't play.
That's exactly – not only is that what I want to happen, I think that is exactly what is happening and is going to happen is to me, this is much ado about nothing. As of right now with the investigation stuff, I think people are so – anxious for the, they're just like rabid wolves waiting for that piece of red meat to be dropped in, and the meat that they're dropping in isn't really that juicy. And once you've prepared yourself to just kind of consume that, you're just like, oh sweet, we got it now. And I don't know, I mean, it's just the wiretap. I mean, like, if we're going to talk about the Sean Miller thing, like, no one knows what the wiretap is actually, what it actually is, if it even exists at all. It's like one source reported this to one reporter who then ran with it, and it's become this blown up thing that, and listen, it might exist. It may be even probable that it exists, and it's very, very bad, but it's just, there's a rush to judgment with all this stuff that's pretty crazy to me. And I don't know. And I say this as someone who very much wants all these programs to burn to the ground. Like, I want all of the cheating to be exposed. It's just like, I'm smart enough to know that like, this isn't it. Like, we're not going to get it via these means, you know?
That's the hardest part, right? And that's the one thing I wanted to ask your opinion of, and we didn't include this in here, but I want to ask your opinion of like, Smalls and I are, we're like Seth Greenberg in the sense that we're coaches, we're not journalists, okay? But you're kind of a journalist. Like, how about all these journalists and media members who have kind of like made their career writing about these coaches who are now acting like what they're hearing is the worst thing they've ever heard ever? It feels like to me, if you've been in the business, like, you've known this goes on forever. And like, Jay Billis, who I really like, is on TV on Saturday morning, like, just destroying Sean Miller. And like, I mean, come on. And yeah. This is not the first time you've ever heard this. And that's the part with the journalism aspect of this that just, it kills me. Because you're right. Like, we don't know anything about the wiretaps. ESPN doesn't have transcripts. Like, they don't have, like, they had nothing in there aside from, oh, this is what we heard from a source. And that's really dangerous, right?
And by the way, the source isn't, the source has to have an agenda. Why would the source, like, this wasn't publicly released. This isn't like the court or the judge ordered like all the evidence to be released and then the reporters come through all the evidence and found this wiretap. This was someone who was inside the courtroom or wherever they're having these briefings and looked over all the evidence and picked this part, this wiretap with Sean Miller, and was like, this is what I'm going to leak. And I mean, it's speculation. Like, I don't think anyone really can figure out who the sources are, but like, who's in this case? It's the FBI versus all the people they arrested, right? I doubt the FBI is calling ESPN reporters and saying like, hey, here's what we have on this guy. You should run this story. So I'm guessing it's one of the guys who's been arrested. I'm guessing it's their law team that is leaking this to kind of control the narrative. And listen, the wiretap might exist. It might even be probable that it exists. It's just, it's very strange to me that this is kind of how we arrived at this point, because this is not how, when I say I want the NCAA or certainly the NCAA, yeah, but like I want all these cheating programs to burn to the ground and I want all the cheaters to be exposed. If you're going about it this way, this is.
Say this, the NCAA is so stupid. They've known about this stuff forever. It's gone on for a long time. And now they're acting. Mark Ebert wants to say, oh, it's like, this is the worst thing that ever happened. We didn't know about it. Like, don't act like that. You knew it for 25, 30 years. Everybody's been doing it. It's happened in the 80s, the 70s. Well, you know, John Wooden was a great coach. You know who he had? He had Papa G. So, like, don't call me that stuff. It just bothers me. It bothers me.
Vitale almost had a heart attack at the Syracuse 2 game talking about Sean Miller. Oh my God.
It was incredible. And here's the other thing. And I know, you know, we're going to go into Coach Speak right after this before Smalls kills me for taking this too long. But like, I know that coaches don't have a lot of free time on their hands, but everything I know about wiretaps, I learned from The Wire. And the one thing I learned was you just don't talk on the phone. Like, right. When you're breaking the rules, and I get that these guys never thought the FBI would be involved, but like, all I can ever think of is like, keep it boring. So here's what I'll tell you, Mark. If Sean Miller was on the phone and he talked to a runner who is entirely uncredible in the first place, but if he talked to Christian Dawkins and was like, yeah, Christian, let's get $100,000 for DeAndre Ayton, I would be legitimately stunned. Like, to the point where like, I don't know what I would do. Like, go to the Final Four and like, I don't know, but I would be absolutely stunned if that happened, because like, it's so stupid. And I don't think these guys are that stupid, especially when you've been cheating for years. Not saying Sean Miller is, but like, programs that have been cheating, like, they've got it down to like a pretty decent science. So the idea that he would discuss that about someone who was already on campus, I can't see it. I just can't.
I'm right there with you. That's the part that's all fishy to me. On top of that, if the FBI has a wiretap of Sean Miller saying, I will give you $100,000 for this player, deliver him to me. Like, if that's pretty much what the quote is, then why is Sean Miller not arrested?
100%. Like, Will Richardson got dragged out in cuffs for way less than that. So
that
something doesn't add up. I agree.
It's very fishy, but I'm not trying to come to Miller's defense with that. I'm not saying like Sean Miller's clean or anything like that. What I'm saying is I don't know, and no one else does. And to pretend like you do know is just irresponsible to me.
100%. All right. We'll go into Coach Speak. Smalls will do the first one. And this is, we kind of pick some coaches and they give us cliches. And then we ask guys in the business to break them down and kind of tell us what they mean. So Smalls, you got the first one. It's from Rick Barnes this weekend.
Yeah, this is Rick Barnes on being a semifinalist for Naismith Coach of the Year. He said, haven't seen anything about it. Haven't heard anything about it. Don't care anything about it. Does Rick Barnes actually care or not care? Do coaches care about anything other than wins and losses?
I say Rick Barnes absolutely does care. He has to care. Rick Barnes, this is a man who made Texas basketball what it is, was shown the door for doing that. And he's got pride. I mean, like, this guy is, he wanted the North Carolina job. He didn't get it. He went to Texas, builds a Texas program up, gets Kevin Durant there. I mean, like, Texas has that for the rest of their existence. They have Kevin Durant. That's invaluable. Rick Barnes, they should be kissing Rick Barnes' feet just for that alone. And And he's pissed off about it. And he wants to be able to rub it in Texas's face that he was the national coach of the year. Yeah, I'm saying he definitely cares.
Yeah, he had made 18 NCAA tournaments in like 20 years, and they showed him the door. And that's the nature of the business. But like this guy, he wants to like put that on his mantle and just like Snapchat it to Texas fans and be like, oh yeah, you wanted to fire me, right? Like this is how bad it is. It's insane.
Also, successful coaches have egos. Like that's just known. It's insane to me to think that like they don't want an award that's going to especially rub it in their other school that fired them's face.
I'll put it this way. You don't, as someone who is in, I'm in journalism. We brought up my journalist, whatever, but, there are journalism awards that exist. There are writing awards that exist for college, even college basketball writers. I would say that it's possible to not care about an award all the way up until you see who won the award. And then you very much care.
You're like, I'm way better than that. Like, dude.
Wait a second. Yeah. That guy.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So this one is from your guys, you and Tate Frazier. Shout out to your co-hosts. Personal favorite coach in NCAA basketball right now. This is from Kevin Stallings. This was like a couple weeks ago. And he said, I think coaches in general live on a hot seat. Do I feel any more pressure? I've never spent a lot of time worrying about that. I try to do the best I can for my players every day. And I said when I took this job, it would be about the players. And that's who it's about. I'll work tonight to help them and be better for Saturday against number one Virginia. And that starts tomorrow. It's about me. It's not about me. It's about them. And I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. And that's help them be successful. And then we know they scored 7 points in the first half against Virginia. So
they had a really good game.
What's going on in Kevin Stallings' mind this past week, do you think? Or this entire year?
If anyone can figure out what's going on in Kevin Stallings' mind, please call me immediately. I've been trying to crack this case for years. I love Kevin Stallings so much, but has Kevin Stallings ever cared about his players?
That's what he's like the poster child for, like, he's an old school guy and like he is an absolutely not a player's coach. Like 100% he's not.
Do you think you guys with the coaching background, do you think that guys like that can be successful in the modern game anymore? Like they're extinct at this point, aren't they? There's like Frank Martin's a hard ass and Kevin Stallings is a hard ass. And I'm trying to think of who else there is.
Like, it's really difficult. Like Izzo is really hard on his guys too, in the sense that they practice really, really hard. Unless your background is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of wins and Sweet 16s and titles, I don't think you can do it anymore as a young guy. Yeah. I just don't think it works. You know, like Smalls worked for Herm McGee, who's got 1,000 wins, but he wasn't that hard on his guy.
With Coach McGee, I love Coach McGee, and everyone knows that. He's really tough on his guys, but at the same point, he's pretty much a human, and those guys know that, and they know they can come into his office and talk with him and things like that. So I do think, to answer your question, I don't think you can be like full on like the old school. Like, you need to have a balance. Like, I know Jay Wright's really tough on his guys, but at the end of the day, he's got their back, and he makes sure. He lets that be known in the media, especially.
That's the important part.
Well, like Frank Martin does that really well. Like, you see him just, I mean, he's one of the few guys that you see just like embarrass his dudes on national TV, but he never lets other guys embarrass his players. Like, and he takes full credit for like mistakes and stuff. Like, I mean, I always remember him like defending Jacob Pullen in 2011 when like Pullen like was so emotional he couldn't give his press conference, and Martin just like basically motherfucked the guy from the podium in the NCAA tournament. But like that, you know, like that's what you see Jim Boeheim did it for Jerry McNamara and stuff. And I think like, if you're going to be a real hardo, that's what you've got to be. Your players have to know that, all right, this guy's going to treat me like absolute crap, but I think either they're Stockholm syndrome or they think deep down the guy really cares about him, you know?
Yeah. I would say that from what I can gather, that does not apply to Kevin Stallings. Famously, the story I love telling, I can't tell it enough. I'm not sure if you guys have heard me tell this story before, but a buddy of mine played for Stallings at Vanderbilt and said that he one time called instead of practice, it was like over the summer, instead of a summer workout, he took the team to play softball because he thought that it would be great to liven the team spirits. You know, like we've been on the grind for so long, let's go play softball. And all the guys like look at each other funny, like, this is weird, what's going on here? And then they get there, and Stallings inserts himself into the game and is in the lineup and is actually playing with the teams and proceeds to just bomb home run after home run and taunt his players as he rounds the bases. So even a gesture like that was supposed to be for his guys, and it's like, hey, I'm going to throw you this bone. It really just ended up being about, like, I want to show you guys that I'm better than you. I'm going to bomb home runs off of you.
The thought of Kevin Stallings playing. So I live in Nashville now, and the thought of like Kevin Stallings like on the baseball diamond at Vanderbilt, like bombing home runs.
I live in Pittsburgh now, so a little connection there.
Well, there you go. It's yeah, there we go.
Terrible. But I think like everybody knew the thing with Kevin Stallings too is like everybody knew. You know, it's very rare in both recruiting and coaching that people say that like something was a bad idea. Like every recruit that signs for a school, recruiting analysts are like, this is a great get. That guy's going to be an awesome player. Like, okay, we have 30% transfer rate. And every coach that gets hired, they're like, oh, he's great with guys. He's going to be awesome. But Kevin Stallings was the first thing that I've ever seen that every single person in the know was like, well, Pittsburgh hired Kevin Stallings. They fired Jamie Dixon, or Jamie Dixon, they ran him out of town, but Kevin Stallings is the guy that's going to like take us to the next level. When like his players in Vanderbilt, like Wade Baldwin, like essentially was telling people how much he hated playing there. Which is like amazing. Like, and again, it's just, it's like when schools and athletic directors do things like that, you just shake your head and you're like, okay, so when you score 7 points in a national TV game and like your student section is 10% full, who are you going to blame? And then you have to pay him $9 million to fire him for without costs. Like, it's crazy.
Scott Barnes. God bless Scott Barnes. Scott Barnes hires him at Pitt and then leaves like almost immediately and leaves Pitt to deal with it all.
All right. And I'm gonna hop into the next segment. City Review. We're gonna do Columbus, Ohio. I know you said you're a boring guy, but this is all I need from you is a couple restaurants, a couple bars, and then I want you to impress me. Me and Tyler are coming to Columbus, Ohio for a weekend with Mark Titus. You can impress us, and I don't care. We can sit and watch games in your living room. I don't really care.
Okay, so we'll start with the restaurants. I got number one. I only need to list one restaurant because this is to me number one, and there is no close second, and it doesn't matter. It's this place called Nancy's Home Cooking. It's a hole in the wall just north of Ohio State's campus. It is, and when I say a hole in the wall, I mean it literally might be just a hole in the wall. Like it's crowded as hell. There's like six places to sit. It's been family owned forever. And they make – you go in there, they'll – I get the same meal every time because there's no point in getting anything else. Chicken and noodles. What they do is they take a plate – they take like a normal-sized dinner plate, throw mashed potatoes on it, spread out the mashed potatoes, take just like spoonful after spoonful – huge spoonful after spoonful of chicken and noodles, throw it on top of the mashed potatoes, throw a little side of green beans, a couple rolls, and like all of that costs, what, $10 maybe? Maybe $11 for that? And when I got at my absolute fattest, I was going there a lot, and that is not a coincidence because that food is unbelievable. It's my favorite restaurant in Columbus by far, and it's something as simple as that. Maybe you're expecting me to say some fine dining place.
No, I wasn't. I don't like fine dining.
That is the spot.
One thing you'll know about me is I'm a big like dive bar, like dive food area. Like that's perfect for me, so I'm in.
Yeah. Nancy's in Clintonville. It is for the listeners that, I mean, listen, if you live in Columbus and you don't know of Nancy's, then you're certainly not learning it from me for the first time. That can't happen. I'm sure you already know for all the people that are, but if you're coming through Columbus, try to check out Nancy's. It's only open till like 3 on most days, 'cause they do like the breakfast lunch thing, but it's definitely worth it. I know like Todd Blackledge at ESPN. He goes there all the time.
Taste of the Town. You probably
yeah,
did that.
Yeah. His Taste of the Town is there all the time. Yeah. He goes there all the time. So I'm not alone in this thought. So anyway, other restaurants I'm trying to think, like there's some other good ones, but I don't know.
One restaurant's good.
That's the best.
What about if we're going out, like take us to a bar in Columbus?
I don't have a good answer for that because I'm again, very boring. I just want beer. So I want a place that just has a lot of beer on tap. And literally any place that has beer on tap, I'll be fine with. I like, but it has to be like a lot of beer. Like I'm a guy that wants to try a lot of different stuff, get the little sample paddle that comes out and then like stick your nose in it and pretend like you can kind of distinguish anything. You stick your nose in it, swirl around, take a drink. You're like, yeah, it tastes like beer. That's beer. All right. So I guess like, I don't have an exact spot, but I would say like places like that is where you would find me. Like the places that have like,
We're looking for a tap room.
Well, I'll tell you who can't come on this trip is one of our former guests, John Rothstein, who can't eat carbs for some reason. He will not be joining us for the noodles and the beer. So, John, you're out.
Most of the beer. There's a place called Pint House that's pretty good, but I don't think it's local to Columbus. It feels like a place that should be a chain if it's not already. but it's called the Pint House, and they have 1,000 beers on tap, and it's kind of like the yuppie place to go in the short north, and I don't know, but whatever. They got good beer. That's all that matters.
That's all that matters.
But again, honestly, if you're going out with me, we are going to literally the closest bar to my house probably at this point. I'm washed up. I'm in my 30s. I live in the suburbs. We're going to B-Dubs. We're going to B-Dubs and getting some boneless wings and like a Miller Lite.
That's perfect. Now, last thing, you just got, let's do something you want to do. Activity, we can go fishing, or we can just like hang out in your living room.
Let's see. I got a few things. So I'm very into the Columbus Crew. That is the number one thing I would say I would like to do in Columbus is go to Crew games. It sounds absolutely ridiculous, but I got into soccer. And I had season tickets for a while. They're taking our team away from us. This is not a happy time to be a Crew fan, but I would say that, but yeah, it's a weird time right now to be a Crew fan because they're trying to take the team away and the fans are fighting like hell to keep it in Columbus. But otherwise I've gotten into curling, and not just because of the Olympics. I took a curling class over the summer, I want to say, or in the fall, something like that. At the Columbus Curling Club.
I am juiced.
That's some fun shit, dude.
Yes, I'm juiced. I've never been curling. That's the best. I'm coming out.
So I'm getting in. I was into curling. I'm going to be a hipster and be like, I was in before the Olympics, but I actually was. My brother brought me along to this class and we did it, and I'm all in on it, and I'm ready to get a membership. And then I got excited watching the Olympics. So
Mark, when John Schuster, like in the gold medal match, had like the big shot against Sweden, I think it was in the eighth end, right? How excited did you actually get?
Oh, I first of all, I stayed up and actually watched it. It was at that shot happened at like 4 o'clock in the morning, it felt like. So just that in and of itself should tell you how excited I was. But then, yeah, I got up off my couch and was like running around the room, dancing and stuff. So, I'm into
curling. And for people that don't know, like, his story is actually amazing. He gets like left off like the high performance curling team that the U.S. because he literally like choked in 2010 and 2014. Like, he was really bad, right?
In all honesty, if he played football or basketball, it would be like the greatest story you've ever heard in your life of redemption. I mean, the guy was so bad, not just bad. Like, the analogy I would use is like, he would get fouled. He would get fouled on a 3-point attempt down by one with like 2 seconds left, like basically every game, and then miss all three free throws, like every single game. It wasn't like we were asking him to hit a half court hook shot. It wasn't like, hey, we need a really miracle here. We just need you to like hit a couple free throws. That's it.
And then he goes from like the start of the Olympics, right, where he's still missing shots, and people are like, "Oh, same old John Schuster." Yes. And then he basically hits a hook shot from half court to win a gold medal. Like, it's incredible. Right. Like, his story, for people who haven't read about it, just Google John Schuster curling. Like, and not just because he allegedly lost 40 pounds, just because he stopped eating pizza 5 times a week, which I also thought was very very funny. But his story is crazy.
Yeah, so that I would do curling. The other thing I should mention that I really love to play board games. So I go to board game bar. There's a board game place in Columbus where they basically serve beer and they have like a whole library of board games. And some friends and I will go there and play board games. And it's not like we don't play like Sorry and Connect Four. Like, we play like the high level shit that has like it's an entire damn book of rules and you got to read through them all and all that kind of stuff. So we get pretty into
it. He's out there playing the cones of Dunshire. We're going to get in.
Yes.
10 touches. Last segment, rapid fire, 30 second answers. Who's the funniest player or funniest person you've ever worked with or played with?
The first name that comes to mind is Thad Mata. That it's surprising. He's a big time coach speak guy, so a lot of people wouldn't realize that. But yeah, he was very very funny.
Okay,
I love Coach Mom. Yeah.
We typically ask our second question is your worst travel experience, but you went to a high major school, so we can assume you didn't have any bad travel experiences. I want to know what the worst thing someone ever said to you was because you were a walk on, either a player or a coach.
I love telling this story at Minnesota. My senior year, when I had started my blog and I was kind of gaining some notoriety and people knew me, everywhere we go on the road, there would be fans that knew who I was. And, it was always cool talking to students in the other student sections. They'd chant my name. Some of them would chant my name to put me in the game at the end of games, cause they just wanted to see me play, cause they read my blog and stuff. So we're playing in Minnesota, and this had happened at a few schools here and there where they knew who I was, and I'd kind of smile and wave and give them a thumbs up and thanks guys. Thanks for reading. Thanks for being a fan. I'm super important, you guys. And this, and in Minnesota, this guy goes, "Hey, Titus." And I turn and look and I give him a thumbs up and he's like, "You have a muffin top, badass."
That's the best.
And then I look down at my stomach and I'm like, "Oh, this guy." And then it completely got in my head. The guy has since reached out to me, by the way. I told this story a couple of years ago. He's since reached out to me like very recently about it. And he's like, "Hey man, I was the guy. I'm sorry. I really didn't. I don't know what got into me. I was an asshole 19-year-old. I really apologize." I was like, "Dude, that's the funniest thing that anyone's ever said to me. So do not apologize." Cause it was absolutely true. I was a little overweight at this point in my career. So that's my answer.
What is your, you can't plug your own book. What's your current favorite book and your current favorite TV show?
Favorite book. I'll give a serious and a fun. Serious book I read is Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis. Changed my life. Love that book. It's become like scripture to me. Absolutely love that book. So that's my serious answer. The one I'm reading right now is A Confederacy of Dunces is what it's called. And it's hilarious. And I love that one. So those would be my two recommendations. My favorite TV show is Game of Thrones. I know it's not on right now, but I've gotten into Game of Thrones. I usually don't go for that stuff. I know I said I'd play board games, but I'm usually not like a fantasy type guy, but, I've been sucked into the Game of Thrones thing just cause I work at the Ringer. I mean, like everyone there,
binge mode, Game of Thrones.
That's pretty much what we're known for.
Bill Simmons indirectly almost killed, Jason Concepcion and,
Mallory Rubin.
Yeah. Cause like they had to watch a million Game of Thrones episodes and like a 6-week period of time. Yeah. Like, I don't know when they slept. It was insane. Like, by the end of the podcast, it just sounded like they were like, "All right, we made it. The new season starts tomorrow."
I'm not on their level, but yeah, I definitely like, I seek out secondary information. You know, I'm not the guy that watches the show and is like, "Oh, that was a good show," and move on. Like, I definitely get online and I'm reading the forums and reading the history of all the characters and all that shit. So, that's probably good. That's probably my answer.
Okay. You did mention that you were thinking about going to medical school and then Bill Simmons plucked you and, you know, gave you this writing career. What would you do if you weren't, we were working in sports, but like if you weren't writing or anything, like if you, you know, if you had to do something different, what would you do?
At this point, you mean?
Yeah.
Or yeah. Like, wait, okay.
No.
At this, cause medical school is definitely out at this point. Honestly, the answer is I would be a math teacher, which is something I'm actually interested in doing anyway. Like I'm going to get my teaching license this summer. I'm curious and pursuing it. Not necessarily. I'm kind of keeping my options open. I think like having the license offers me some flexibility. So I'm going to see like what I'm not trying to get out of the journalism game. Certainly the world would crumble without my takes, but, I have a passion for working with children. I have a passion for math, actually, surprisingly enough. And that just like, I, that seems like a perfect fit for me. I know a lot of people have horror stories of teaching and I'm well aware of them. And, but I don't know. I grew up in a teaching family. Both my parents were teachers. My sister's a teacher. So, I don't know. It's just something I've always been interested in. So that's probably my answers. I'd be like either a junior high math teacher or like an AP calculus teacher. That's probably either one of those.
That's pretty cool. What is the wildest thing you've ever seen at an AAU basketball tournament?
It's got to be the first thing that comes to mind when I hear you ask this is Daquan Cook, the night after his prom. We were playing a game in Fort Wayne, Indiana. His prom was in Dayton, Ohio. If you Google Maps that shit, it's like it's not. Yeah. We're playing our game tips off at I want to say 8 a.m. in Fort Wayne, the night after Daquan's prom. Daquan was not supposed to come to the game, but then word comes out like the night before that he's going to try to make it to the game somehow. I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. But I was supposed to. So the game's getting ready to start. Daquan's not there. It's probably 8:02 at this point. We're getting ready to tip off. Daquan's not there. So I think I'm about to start because we played the same position on the team. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to start in this game. So I started taking it a little more seriously. Daquan comes running in right before tip, quickly throws on his shoes and takes my spot. And I'm talking like as quick as possible. Like the horn had already sounded for the guys to be on the floor. And Daquan comes running in, right? So he throws on his shoes. Greg Oden wins the tip, tips it back to Conley. Daquan was at half court, just takes off sprinting towards the goal. Mike throws a half court lob to him from half court, just throws it up. Daquan catches it and flushes it. And I'm sitting there like, what the hell just happened? We go down on defense, get a stop. We come back. Daquan posts up, catches the ball about 10 feet off the block, turns and faces, takes one dribble, spins baseline, hits a fadeaway. And I go, what the, what, what is happening? This is, so this was his, the night after prom without stretching. I'm not going to snitch on Daquan, but I'm going to guess at prom, he may have partaked in some illegal, some illicit substances. And he shows up, drives all the way over. He's operating on 2 hours sleep, no stretching, catches a lob from half court and hits a fadeaway. And I was like, this is unbelievable. And that was kind of the moment I knew that, you know, I'm doomed. My college career is
some
doomed.
People are bored.
Some guys can do that. Yeah. Right. So that's probably my answer.
All right. If you could change one thing about college basketball, what would it be?
I'm gonna go the other way from what a lot of people probably say. I think coaches and administrators should make less money instead of paying the players. I think I'm actually okay with the players not making money. I think we should try to get back to like just what it was in the beginning when John Wooden was making $75,000 a year, and that was like his salary. Yeah, that's not true, but you know what I'm saying? Like because college basketball is structured such that these coaches are just trying to mold these young men, and like this is just kind of an extracurricular thing we do on the side. And it's like, listen, I'll buy into that bullshit if coaches aren't making $10 million a year, you know? So I think that would be my answer, is that I actually don't mind the players not getting paid. I mind that everyone else is getting just absurd amount of money. So if there's like a salary cap, like $1 million a year for a coach, or like $500,000, I don't know what it would be. But
for some staff, sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
That would make something sense. Like that.
I don't know. I know you guys being coaches are probably
no. I don't care. I like I said, my cap was $1,000 a year. So
we've made far less than that in our coaching careers.
Most that's good.
I know that solution is never going to happen because it's not feasible at all. But that is like my dream scenario is that to not have TV drive everything, to not have like the Final Four. What if at the Final Four we gave more tickets to students? I don't know. Is that something that could happen? I mean, like, what if
it was not a literally? You were talking about this before.
Yeah, literally every decision.
Before you came on, like, we were talking about this, just to derail us for 1 second, about how, like, if the FBI came in and they were like, all right, Mark Emmert, here's the problem. There's been so much cheating. We want to not have the NCAA tournament this year because we need there to be punishments. We need to figure this out. Like, the NCAA would lose their shit about that. They'd be like, there's billions of dollars on the line. Like, we can't do that. And so at that point, you're just like, okay, well, this is not, like you said, it's not an extracurricular activity anymore. It's beyond that at this point.
Right. All right. So that's my answer.
Most absurd rumor you ever heard. You can leave names if you want.
Most absurd rumor I have ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm... Like, we've heard some stuff working at Temple, wherever.
In coaching, I would guess.
I guess all the good rumors I can think of are they're only good in the context if you know who I'm talking about. So, what about Brad Stevens to IU? That's a good rumor.
We always heard back in the day when he took the Celtics job that, like, he wasn't going to be successful there, and that was just lining up for him to go take the Duke job when Coach K was done. I guess that would have been now 5 years ago, and Brad Stevens is, you know, arguably the best coach in the NBA. So not as much anymore.
I would say, I guess I'll put it this way. The best rumors I've heard have generally been about Mark Gottfried, and I'll leave it at that. And if you know anything about Mark Gottfried, you kind of know the tone that those rumors might take. So I'll just say that the best rumors I've heard have been about Mark Gottfried.
Awesome. One program you want to coach, obviously not Ohio State, and we love the Duquesne push last year, so maybe it's the Duquesne. I don't know.
I'm trying to think. Like, I think the best coaching jobs in the country are the football schools, maybe because I just played at Ohio State and I'm kind of biased by that, but you can get away with like being – there's not as much pressure, I don't think, but you still have the resources from the football money and stuff. So I'm trying to think of like, if I can't pick Ohio State, like Texas to me would be an insane job. You get to live in Austin, Texas. Yeah. They have more money than they know what to do with. You have like Texas as a state is an insane recruiting pool. If you can just get, you could field a team with just Texas guys and be good. Now I'm starting to realize what Rick Barnes was maybe for Stone. No, but, wait, now it's starting to make more sense. Wait a second. Only went the one Final Four with all that shit. But no, that would be like that would be a great, great gig. Otherwise, if that's my major answer. If we're talking about like high major program, I would probably pick like a Texas, which, I think most people probably expect me to pick Duke or Kansas or something. But my lower major is probably like, I'm going to do the stereotypical cliche, like Pepperdine or Hawaii or something like that. Like, I don't know.
Hey, Pepperdine's open. We'll make a push. We'll start it now.
Yeah, it is.
All right. Greatest game you have ever been a part of?
Oh, greatest game I've ever been a part of. Objectively, removing everything from everything, I would say the greatest just in a vacuum game was probably against Siena in 2009 in NCAA tournament, the first round. We went to double overtime. We lost in double overtime against Siena. And there were just like there must have been 10 game winning shots hit in that
Ronald
game.
Where's
like the guy
right?
hit it and you're like, yeah, Ronald Moore. Yeah, you're like, oh, well, that's game over. And then they go hit a shot. And you're like, well, that's got to be game over. And then we'd hit a shot. And you're like, well, there it is. That's it. That's the dagger. And then, you know, like that just kept going on back and forth. So that's probably my answer.
Three basketball people you would want to have dinner with, dead or alive?
I'll say Larry Bird is the obvious one that comes to mind. Bob Knight would probably have been on this list a few years ago. 10 years ago, babe, certainly, but he has not aged gracefully. So can I say like 1992 Bob Knight?
Yeah. That guy's long dead anyway. Yeah. 1992 Bob Knight.
Yeah, he's dead. I would say that version of Bob Knight. I'm an Indiana guy, by the way. If you haven't picked that up, Larry Bird and Bob Knight. Should I make it three for three and say John Wooden?
I think you want to add Damon Bailey to your table. You know, you grew up on Damon Bailey.
Damon Bailey, yeah. I would say, my last answer might be LeBron. Like, I find LeBron so fascinating, not so much for what he does on the court or even – I find it fascinating that a guy was at 15, 16 years old, was exalted and put on the cover of Sports Illustrated and did not turn out to be a turd. And I think that's, like, the biggest upset in sports history that happened. And I just want to pick his brain and understand, like, how did that happen? Like, how did you not become just a huge dick to everybody? And I don't know. I mean, it makes sense, right? Like he should have had his childhood star. Like every Hollywood child star goes through some crazy. You know,
it's been amazing that like the worst thing that ever happened to him was the decision. Like every other decision that's made, like in terms of you know no off court problems and stuff. The problem with having dinner with LeBron is you wouldn't be able to serve beer. You'd have to serve red wine.
That's
so it's over now.
I guess maybe I don't want to have dinner. I just want to interview him. I just want to ask him like one question. Like, did you know all this time that you like what is it about your situation that made you not become a turd where everyone else did? Like, I'm just very curious about
right,
that.
Yeah. Because in a vacuum, like his situation is not different from a lot of things that we've seen other than the fact that he was covered in the height of like the social media era kind of starting. Like, you know, it's odd.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah,
it's,
if we can get LeBron on the Create Your Shot podcast, we'll let you come on.
All right. Yeah, let me come on. And
that's definitely going to happen. Unless his email is lebron.james@gmail.com, which we might try. We're probably not going to get him. Parting shots. Same two questions we ask every guest. I'll go first. Mark, what's the best advice you've ever been given?
Best advice. Honestly, here's the answer. I almost said something else, but this is the real answer. When I was asked by Scott Van Pelt to come on his March Madness show, they did a competing show with CBS for Selection Sunday. And he had me and Jay Billis and I think Carol Lawson were like the three people he was having come on. Right. And I was nervous as shit. They flew me up to Bristol for it. I was going to be on TV on Selection Sunday, the one day that people care, you know, a ton about basketball. I knew a ton of people are going to be watching this. And I was very, very nervous. And he pulls me aside about an hour, maybe 30 minutes before we're going live. And he goes, remember, Mark, I have Jay Billis here to be Jay Billis. I don't need you to be Jay Billis. I need you to be Mark Titus. And he said that. And I just felt like this huge weight just fall off my shoulders. And in that moment, I was like, yeah, that's absolutely true. Because I think that I had this pressure to sort of go out there and pretend to be college basketball expert or this or that, you know, and for him to just be like, listen, I like you for what you are. And that's totally fine for this situation. It honestly has changed my approach to my career. And it's like, I've stopped trying to get people to like me, if that makes sense. Like I kind of brought up the example earlier where people are like, man, this guy doesn't do enough X's and O's. It's like, fine. I mean, I'm not changing who I am for you. I'm sorry. This is just who I am. So that's my answer was SVP with that very, When you write it out, it's not really that profound, but the way he delivered it was very profound.
All right, last question. Face-to-face with your 18-year-old self, an 18-year-old Mark Titus, what are you telling him?
you have no idea what's coming, I guess. Yeah. Like that, you're about to be shocked at what your life is going to look like in the next 12 years. That's pretty much it. Like I thought when I was 18, I thought I was going to Harvard when I was 18, actually. And then that fell through. But even then, I thought I was going to Ohio State to be a math major and go to medical school and become an orthopedic surgeon. And that was going to be my life. And that is very much not my life right now. And it worked out very well for me, and I'm very happy with where I am. But I guess enjoy the ride, something cliche like that. Enjoy the ride.
Yeah, if you were an orthopedic surgeon and somebody might have been like, hey, you know, did you hear this thing about Sean Miller? And you'd be like, yeah, you know, I haven't had Sean Miller in my office for a couple of weeks. Does that guy live outside of Dayton, Ohio? You know, you might not. You might.
Right,
instead, exactly. You got to hop off this podcast and go talk about whether or not players are getting paid money that, like, yep. we pretty much right. all know that they might be. But, Mark, yep. I appreciate it. We went a little longer than we thought. And
yeah, no worries. I talk too much.
No, I mean, this is what we want in the podcast. Like, people hear Smalls and I talk. They don't really care as much about our opinion. You know, we might get 15 listeners because of you. You know, maybe you have a bigger family. But I do want, for people that don't know, I'm quite sure most of our guests do follow you on Twitter and do kind of know a little bit about what you do outside of going on podcasts with people you've never met before. But I would like you to plug yourself just a little bit in the least egotistical sure. way that you can.
Yeah. So I have a verified Twitter account with 153,000 followers because I'm very famous and successful.
You're 7% oh, real though, right?
Oh, did you say? Yeah, I know. There's 7% real. That's why I like making fun of that. Did you say least egotistical? I'm sorry. I misheard that. I'm at Club Trillion on Twitter. We have fun on there. We make jokes. Our podcast I do is called One Shining Podcast. I did not come up with the name before anyone tries to roast me for that. But it's college basketball, sometimes more than that. That's pretty much it. I write for theringer.com and,
I mean, there it is. That's his bio. We did an hour and 20 minutes. Maybe we could have done it in, you know, 2.5, but Mark, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for taking the time. It's been awesome. And, I look forward to kind of seeing where this season goes, and we'll write down some of your predictions and we'll see what happens. Hopefully, like I said, Ohio State Temple in the vacated NCAA tournament championship.
That would be absolutely awesome. Thanks. All right,
man. We'll talk to you.